Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all, but we're especially delighted to welcome students from Loyola Academy. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. It's sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students across the state to join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, these students are given materials about the case. They might do some activities around the case. They come for an oral argument. And then after the second case, they meet with a justice who was assigned that day to meet with the students. The discussion is the procedure of the court in accepting and deciding cases, not the substantive issues involved in the case. Everyone is invited to join the students and hear and participate in the discussion. We have a synopsis of this case, and if anyone would like to have a copy of that synopsis, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give it to you. We've got one hand raiser. Two, three, four, five. Do I hear four? Well, that's good. It's difficult enough to follow arguments sometimes, but if you know the facts from reading this short synopsis and the legal issues, you will be able to follow the proceedings better. Let me now introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice who will be with you after the second case to talk about the procedures of the court. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To his left is Justice Patience Robinsack. And to the far left is Justice Gableman. Now, I carefully explained to you about the Court with Class, but we also have a University of Wisconsin Law School class taught by former Justice Lewis Butler. And with that class, please stand, along with Justice Butler. Thank you, and you're all welcome. You may be seated. I'll now call our first case, which is 08AP967AC, Karen Schill et al. Versus Wisconsin Rapids School District et al. Arguing on behalf of Karen Schill and others is Gina Jonan of WEAC. Ms. Jonan.
May it please the court. My name is Gina Jonan, appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellants Karen Schill, Tracy Pronga, Kimberly Martin, Robert Dresser, and Mark Larson, all teachers in the Wisconsin Rapids School District. Seated to my right is Melanie Swink, representing the amicus, Office of the City of Milwaukee Attorney. This case is about a record custodian that, admittedly uncertain of the law, misapplied the legislature's definition of a record to erroneously encompass the teacher's personal emails. I will address three reasons why the court should reverse the circuit court's order and enjoin the release of the teacher's personal emails. First, in accordance with national precedent, personal emails are not records as defined by the law because the teachers prepared their emails solely for their personal use. Second, even if the court determines that the emails are records, then they are still not subject to disclosure under the balancing test, because there is no public interest served by releasing purely personal materials. Third, the court need not address any last-minute argument by the amicus that the court somehow lacked the power to correct the custodian's misinterpretation of the law, because any argument regarding the circuit court's competency has been waived. Starting with my first point, personal emails are not records as defined by the law, because the teachers prepared those emails solely for their personal use. The court employs a two-step process to determine if a custodian made the proper decision to release records under the law. First, the court looks at the statutory definition, including any statutory exclusions or common law exclusions, to the materials requested. Here, the personal emails are not records as defined by the law. The legislature crafted a definition of records in 1932, Section 2, to exclude records prepared as drafts, notes, preliminary computations, or like materials prepared for personal use. Here, the teachers prepared their personal emails for their personal use. The emails in question do not relate to any school business. The teachers did not rely on these emails to conduct any school function, and the teachers did not use these emails to take any official acts.
Ms. Jonan, let me, if I might interrupt you for a minute. Isn't it quite likely that there would be emails that would have mixed content? In other words, that would have personal information and business information as well? How are those to be handled?
Yes, Your Honor. In that case, the custodian would exercise its duties under the law to redact the personal information and allow the disclosure of the governmental information.
That sounds like a pretty heavy burden for the custodian, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. It's not any more of a heavy burden than custodians already have under the law, because under the law, the custodian needs to look at all the materials it has to determine if those materials are responsive to a requester's request. The custodian then needs to look at each individual document to determine if there's any information that is not subject to disclosure under the law. The custodian already has the legal responsibility to redact any information that is not subject to disclosure, and then to disclose any material that is subject to disclosure. In addition, Your Honor, this court has already stated in the Board of Regents versus Osborne case that merely the burden of redacting information does not relieve the custodian of its responsibility under the law.
Counselor, subsequent to our decision in Wisnicki, the legislature restricted by quite a lot the availability of judicial review for a custodian's decision about releasing the records. Can you tell me a little bit why you think the teachers fall within one of those categories for whom judicial review is appropriate?
Certainly, Your Honor. I have two responses to that. The first response is when the teachers filed their complaint in circuit court, they proceeded pursuant to 19356, because in 19356, it allows for judicial review where the records are related to the investigation of a potential policy violation of an employer's policy. Here, the teachers received notice that the district was going to release their emails in response to a request by Mr. Buchholz. The teachers knew that Mr. Buchholz was seeking the emails because he thought that the teachers violated the school policy. However, once the teachers were in circuit court, the district confirmed that there was no violation of any computer policy. There was no misconduct at issue. So once the teachers were in court, they should not be prohibited from arguing that the materials the district sought to release were not records as defined by the law. Secondly, 19356 does allow judicial review if it's done pursuant to other statutes, and the teachers did plead mandamus in the alternative. However, this court need not address any competency argument by the circuit court because that argument has been waived.
Well, Counselor, you know, if we're to determine whether or not the emails are records, don't we have to interpret the statute in order to do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, is that really then a competency argument, or are we just interpreting the statutes?
It's our position that the court would be exercising its inherent authority to interpret statutes, as this court instructed in the Department of Administration case, that the teachers were entitled to seek judicial review because it argues the custodian interpreted incorrectly the definition of a record. And the circuit court had the authority to correct that misinterpretation.
So which exception under subsection 2 does your client's advance serve as the basis for the argument that the emails here do not constitute a record?
It would be the definition of a record. Because
there are several items listed, though.
Yes, emails would, we do not dispute that emails related to school business would be records under the law, under the definition in 1932, section 2. But within that long definition of what a record is, it also says what a record is not. And a record is not materials prepared for the originator's personal use.
But it says record does not include drafts, comma, notes, comma, preliminary computations, and the like materials. Are you advancing the argument that the emails here are like materials or fall within one of the other enumerated exceptions?
That the emails would be like materials. As the Wisconsin Counties Association argues, a note can be seen as a draft, a brief informal letter. Emails are similar to a brief informal note or letter. The key is that the teachers prepared the emails for their personal use. The emails here did not relate to any government function.
Doesn't it depend on what you mean by personal use? After all, the whole point about an email is to send it to someone else. So it's not only your personal use, but someone else's personal use, too.
That's correct, but as long as it's for personal use, it is not a record under the law. Here, the teachers, while they did send the emails to others, the emails at issue here involve emails to their friends or family regarding dinner arrangements or social plans or child care responsibilities. The teachers prepared those emails for their personal use. They serve no governmental function, no governmental use. The Court of Appeals in State versus Pankin applied a similar use test when it determined that a judge's personal notes were not subject to release under the public records law because the judge prepared those notes for his own convenience.
Counselor, I think Pankin goes further than that. I think Pankin says that the judge's notes were drafts of his final opinion, and it seems to me you are disconnecting the phrase for personal use from the items specified as exceptions to the record, and we didn't do that. The decision in Pankin did not do that. So how is it you think you can disconnect them, or do you make the connect, as you said to Justice Gableman, that these are, quote, like matters?
That these are like materials prepared.
How is it like a draft? How is an email like a draft of an opinion?
It's more like a note. For example, if a teacher's husband had called her at school and asked her to pick up some milk on the way home, and she scribbled a note to herself to pick up milk on the way home, that just because she wrote that note on government paper with a government pen, it was for her personal use. So similarly, if her husband emails her at work and asks her to pick up milk on the way home, that would also be for her personal use. And in addition, if you read the definition of a record in accordance with the purpose behind the public records law in 1931, that the purpose of the law is to offer insight into government and to insight into official affairs, here these emails offer no insight into government or no insight into the official acts of the teachers. For example, if a teacher emails her husband to remind him to go to the bank, or emails her son to pay his rent while he's at college, or emails her mother asking how she's feeling because she's had the flu, those materials don't serve any governmental function or any government purpose. They don't.
Counsel, how do you respond to the argument that Chapter 16, which deals with the retention of records, has specified that the records are made or received by any state agency or its officers or employees in connection with the transaction of public business? You seem to be arguing that concept, but without that language. That language doesn't appear in Chapter 19. It only appears in Chapter 16. How do you respond to that?
That's correct, but that language is in 1931, which discusses the purpose behind the public records law, that the purpose is to allow insight into the affairs of government. The presumption of disclosure is, in 1931, consistent with the conduct of government business. And this court has instructed that when interpreting a statute, the court should look at the purpose behind the law and read statutes in harmony, not in isolation, but in a context as a whole. And reading the definition of a record in 1932, Section 2, in harmony with the purpose behind the law in 1931, leads to the result that emails prepared for personal use are not records under the public records law.
Ms. Jones, I'd like to go to another subject for just a moment, if we might. You talked about competency. You talked about the fact that you thought that was waived. How is competency different than standing? Because my understanding in reading the briefs is there's a standing issue also. Or do you think they're linked totally together?
Standing is different than competency, Your Honor, because competency involves the legislature restricting the court's ability to hear a case, whereas standing is whether the proper party is before the court. So standing looks at if a person has a personal stake in the outcome of the case or will be affected by the decision in the case. Here, the teachers have standing because it is their emails that the custodian is seeking to release. They are the people that will be personally affected by the disclosure of their personal information.
Well, are you saying that the standing issue has been waived also, or what's your position on standing?
Yes, our position is that it's not truly a standing argument, that really what the Department of Justice has done is mixed standing and competency, that they're really arguing a competency question because they're saying that the legislature restricted the court's ability to hear the action, but that any argument regarding competency has been waived because, as this court found in the McCrutt case, challenges to a circuit court's competency must be raised in the circuit court or they are deemed waived. Now, the court can exercise its inherent power to determine the competency question in an exceptional case, but that is not the case here. This case is a classic case where waiver rules must apply, because it is in the interest of judicial economy to hold parties accountable to raise issues regarding competency in the circuit court. Because in the circuit court, the court could have properly addressed any objection regarding competency. The teachers likewise would have had fair notice of that issue and would have had the opportunity to supplement the record or take any discovery that was needed or even amend their pleadings if there was any question. But the teachers were denied that opportunity by the amici waiting to raise that issue until the case reached the court's doorstep a few months ago. So it is not proper for the amici to raise arguments that were not presented by the lower courts or even by the parties in this case. As the United States Supreme Court has held, it is not the proper role of amici to raise issues on appeal that were not preserved in the lower courts.
Yeah, I asked two questions. Are we talking about only outgoing emails?
No, Your Honor. The requester is seeking all emails from the teacher's work computer during a six-week period. And
That means incoming email?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be emails that Wisconsin citizens sent to the teachers and emails that the teachers sent outside the school district.
So it would be spouses, children, parents, friends, doctors?
That's correct, Your Honor. The custodians made the decision to release all the teachers' emails, irregardless of who they were sent to, who sent the emails to them, what the content of the emails were.
On this competency issue, suppose there were no question of waiver, but the question of competency had been timely raised. How do you address the language in the relatively new statute then?
The teachers submit that the circuit court had competency initially under 19356 because the requester was seeking emails for the purpose of seeing if the teachers had complied with school policy about not emailing regarding school board candidates or the school board election. Then once in circuit court, the district confirms and has confirmed it to this court in its brief that there was no investigation related to the teachers' emails. But once in court, the teachers had the opportunity to argue that the personal emails were not records as defined by the statute. Alternatively, the teachers pled mandamus, asking the circuit court to instruct the custodian to comply with its duty under the law to only release information that is subject to disclosure under the public records law. So under either avenue, the circuit court had competency to decide the case. But the key point is that that issue wasn't litigated in the circuit court, so the circuit court never addressed which avenue the teachers were there under because no party raised that issue. And in fact, the custodian sent the teachers notice because it wanted a decision on whether or not the information was a record or not. And the custodian suggests in its brief to this court that had the custodian known that the materials were not a record, it wouldn't have made the decision to release them to the requester. So the parties here sought the appropriate avenue of going to the circuit court to have the court interpret the definition of a record. And that was the issue that was litigated in the circuit court. That was the issue that the Court of Appeals asked this court to entertain, and that is the issue that this court accepted for review. The teachers are asking the court to decide whether personal emails are public records.
What is the relationship between 19.356 and our Was Nikki case? That seems to have been a subject of dispute in these briefs.
In terms of whether 19.36 applies, the teachers submit that 19.36 would apply in the sense that the custodian does not have the authority to release information that is not subject to release under the public records law. So here, the custodian is misinterpreting the definition of a record to encompass purely personal emails. When the legislature drafted 19.356 in 1936, it could not have contemplated to give the parties no avenue for relief if a custodian was making an improper decision to release materials under the law. For example, 19.36 prohibits the disclosure of trade secrets. So if you imagine a scenario where a business knows that the government is going to release its trade secret under the law, that under the amici's interpretation, the business would have to sit back and wait for a trade secret to be released before it could file action in circuit court. The legislature could not have contemplated such a scenario. It is far better to allow that business to go to circuit court to construct the proper definition of trade secret before that information is released and the business is harmed. Likewise, here, the teachers sought review of whether personal emails are records under the law. If they're not records, then the requester was not entitled to access those emails.
Counsel, in order for you to get on in the text under the phrase or like and like materials, you focus on the word notes, as I understand it. Not drafts, not preliminary computations, but notes. Am I correct or incorrect?
We focus on the phrase like materials for personal use.
Like what? Like a draft?
Like a draft or like a note or any other material that you would...
I don't think that emails are like drafts. As Justice Rogensack earlier indicated, you know, we have drafts of opinions, but I don't consider emails like a draft. I also don't consider emails like preliminary computations. Drafts, I think, are preliminary something in nature. So that leaves me with notes. I've been taking notes of what you've been saying. That's one definition of note. There are several definitions. It seems like you are espousing the definition that's akin to after oral arguments, don't bother or do bother writing me a thank you note, whichever may apply. No, I'm not saying that at all. strike that from the record. What authority do you have to define notes in the statute as though it were a short letter, which seems to be your definition of notes?
Well, the Wisconsin Counties Association cited to the dictionary about the plain meaning of what is a note. But even if the court finds that they aren't notes...
Oh, look, I note that's correct answer. I also note that before I came out here, I was humming a song and music notes. So You know, plain language is a little difficult when you're dealing with a word with multiple definitions. You're espousing a definition as I hear it that is akin to a short letter, a note. What authority do you have for that definition?
Other than the plain meaning of the word note, Your Honor, that when the court is interpreting a statute, it also looks to the purpose behind the statute. And the purpose here in 1931 is to offer insight regarding the conduct of government and governmental business. So the court needs to interpret statutes in harmony with the surrounding text, not in isolation. So if the court looks at that definition in regards to the purpose of the public records law, the purpose of the public records law is to give information regarding the conduct of government. And so here, emails to your family, friends, significant others about your social plans or other personal business that you need to take care of are not records under the law. These aren't records that the legislature was worried about requesters having access to, that the legislature carved out an exception for materials prepared for personal use, regardless of where those materials were kept. If the legislature wanted a mere possession test, which is what the requester is asking for, he's asking for the emails just because they were kept by the government. But the legislature didn't contemplate a mere possession test. If it had, it wouldn't have excluded the language allowing for personal use.
Who's the custodian of the emails?
The district is the custodian.
This definition of the record includes like materials. Now, that can't open it up to everything. On the other hand, it has to be broader than drafts, notes, preliminary computations. Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And record is defined in the first sentence as means any material. So if we substitute the word for the meaning, we would say any material on which written, drawn, printed, spoken, visual, or electromagnetic information. Is email electromagnetic information?
Not to my knowledge.
So we don't even have email set forth other than maybe it's written, maybe it's printed. Electromagnetic information is recorded or preserved regardless of physical form or characteristics. That's the definition of record. Then you say, but it doesn't include all this written, drawn, printed, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't include drafts, notes, preliminary computations, and like materials. The exact word that is used in defining record in the first sentence. And materials means on which written, drawn, printed, spoken, visual, or electromagnetic information is recorded. So it's a little circular.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why looking at the purpose behind the public records law is critical here.
Well, how do you get around 19.3561 that says, except as authorized in this section or otherwise provided by statute, no authority is required to notify a record subject prior to providing a request or access to a record containing information pertaining to that record subject. And no person is entitled to judicial review of the decision of an authority to provide a requester. You fall under any 2A, 1, 2, or 3?
Yes, Your Honor, because it states in 19356 that people are entitled to judicial review if otherwise provided by statute.
And where do you fall in otherwise provided by statute?
That the teachers alternatively pled for mandamus in their complaint, but the circuit court did not address which avenue the teachers were proceeding under because no party raised that issue in the circuit court.
They didn't have to give notice in this case, did they?
I see that my time has expired. May I answer your question?
I would suggest you do.
Yes, they were not required to give notice if they want records related to an investigation, but nothing in that statute prohibits them from sending notice either.
But they were not required to give notice, but they're not prohibited. That's your response.
Correct.
Thank you, Counsel.
Counsel.
Justice Prosser.
Justice Bradley asked you about who was the custodian. And you said the district?
Yes.
In this case, is the district him or a her?
It's an entity, so I would say it, actually.
Well, what about this phrase, materials which are pure? purely the personal property of the custodian and have no relation to his or her office.
Yes, Your Honor. Under the statute, an authority has to designate a legal custodian whose authority is to do its duties under the public records law. So when a requester makes a request, it submits a request to the custodian. So here, the district would be the person designated as the custodian. In this case, it was Dr. Crisp, the superintendent.
So your position was that the phrase that I just read provides no basis to help your case.
It could, in the sense that it's another intent of the legislature to exclude documents that are meant for personal use. So it demonstrates that the legislature, when it crafted the public records law, intended for the public to have access to government materials and conduct relating to the official acts of government, not to have access to purely personal materials that serve no government purpose.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Robert Burns, representing Wisconsin Rapid School District, and Robert Crist.
May it please the court. I'm Robert W. Burns, and with me at council table is Attorney Jeffrey Lacey with the Davis and Kielthau SC Green Bay office on behalf of defendant respondents, Wisconsin Rapid School District, and Dr. Robert Crist. Evidenced by the amount of paper that this case has generated, it's clear we've not yet reached the paperless society that some predicted a few years ago at the advent of electronic communication. Nonetheless, electronic communications in the form of email and electronic transfer of documents has taken a predominant role in the practical day-to-day methods of communication, both in the public and the private sectors. As demonstrated by the issues before the court in this matter, however, the application of important legal provisions in Wisconsin law to this style of communication in the public sector was not contemplated when those laws were first written, nor has there been specific legislative guidance to help us since the advent of electronic communication. There's no question in this matter that the Wisconsin Rapid School District is an authority, as contemplated under the public records law, and that first the interim superintendent, Dr. Robert Cavanaugh, and then subsequently superintendent Dr. Robert Crist were custodians, as that term is used in the statutes. Upon receipt of a request, a custodian, who typically are not lawyers, are required to first determine if requested materials are a record, and if so, whether any exemptions apply from the presumption of disclosure, either through statutory exemptions or as the result of a balancing test that has been developed under common law. The custodians in this instance were confronted by questions which had not been answered to date with regard to email communications, and I believe all parties agree these are issues of first impression with regard to email. The content of these emails did not concern public business, but are they records as that term is defined under Wisconsin law? And in looking at the definition that has been the subject of the argument this morning, the custodians concluded yes. And in looking at the balancing test, would the balancing test result in any public interest in non-disclosure overcoming the strong public interest and presumption of disclosure? It's also noteworthy that the request in this matter came to the district shortly and was reviewed by the district and answered by the district shortly after this court's decision in Zellner. And that decision strongly reminded custodians that the presumption in favor of disclosure is one of the strongest public policy provisions in Wisconsin law. Walking through the custodian's analysis for a moment, the term record applies to items created or kept by an authority. The request in this matter sought emails contained on the district's computer system within the email accounts within the district's system for 5 separate teachers for a period of about 1.5 months in 2007. That is what distinguishes these items from the example raised by appellants of the note an employee puts in their desk. Here, the authority itself maintains constant and total control and access over the items contained in its computer system and does not do so as to the contents of each employee's desk. The argument has been made that the district was under no obligation under Chapter 16 to maintain the emails in the first place. However, as noted, the definition in Chapter 16 is different than the definition in Chapter 19, and Chapter 16 deals with an obligation to maintain records. Doesn't help us in this case because the records were maintained. Whether the district had to maintain them or not is a question asked too late at the time the request is made. If the district has them, the records are there and they're kept by the authority. So when confronted with a request, the record custodian is required to review all documents that are potentially responsive to the request that are maintained by the authority, whether or not the authority was required to maintain them in the first place. As the request here pertained only to emails in the district-controlled system, it would be very difficult for the custodian not to conclude they were kept by the district. So then we turn to the exclusions that we've been looking at.
If emails are deleted, are those kept?
If they have been deleted prior to the request, then the district would not, the custodian would not have them available to look at, and thus they would not have been kept at the point the request was being responded to, Your Honor.
Is custodian defined in the statute?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is that?
Counsel, are you sure about that, that deleted emails aren't able to be retrieved? And I think they often are.
There may be ways for deleted emails to be electronically retrieved out of a system, but that the emails at issue here were those that were readily available based on a review of the electronic files by the custodian, Your Honor.
I see. Never mind. I see.
You have the definition of custodian, Your Honor? In looking at the exclusions, the first, the two that are relevant, as we've been discussing, are the originator's personal use and the materials that are the purely the personal property of the custodian. The second is not pertinent because we're talking about these were not the personal property of the custodian. These were not Dr. Chris or Dr. Kavanaugh's emails. These were emails of teachers, and thus the custodian exclusion would not apply. So we're back to the originator's personal use, the drafts, notes, preliminary computations, and like materials prepared for the originator's personal use. And where the exclusion appears to break down with regard to the originator's personal use is that the personal use is gone once they are transmitted beyond that person's own use. And emails are, once transmitted, now in the possession of a third party and are being used by someone other than the originator. They're no longer drafts. They're a finished product which has been transmitted to a third party and thus cannot be viewed as being only for the originator's personal use at that time.
Could I ask a question? I used to be a district attorney. I don't recall whether I ever asked for a wiretap. But if a district attorney asks for a wiretap of one of these five plaintiffs, would you put that wiretap on without going through all the procedures in the statute?
A wiretap, Your Honor, in a as part of a criminal investigation would be done pursuant to a warrant that would have been secured prior to that time, as opposed to in this instance where the emails are in the district system subject to the district policy, which states that the emails are the property, that the system is the property of the district, and there should be no expectation of privacy in the emails that are in the district
system.
Well,
what I'm trying to get at is if you have a public employee making telephone calls from a public phone, I think that you would have to get a warrant to me the district's position would be that a district attorney could say, I want all the past emails of a particular employee. And in fact, why don't you give me the emails every single day, at the end of the day? It's equivalent like to a wiretap on the current means of communication. Isn't that a little troublesome?
Your Honor, the difficult nature of this case is exactly why the custodian invited the subjects, the originators of the emails, to seek judicial review. But with regard to Your Honor's analogy of the wiretap, I think a critical difference is that the wiretap would be a simultaneous interference and interruption with the communication, as opposed to in this instance where an electronic form of a document has been originated and is now been kept and stored in the district system and is in the possession of the authority and the custodian.
Yeah, but if there was a request that said, I want all of Justice Bradley's emails today, and then tomorrow I want all of her emails tomorrow, and whatever it is, Thursday, Friday, whatever it is, give me a daily report of all her emails. And every public employee in Wisconsin could be subject to that kind of thing, not with any warrant, but just under public records law. And we don't maybe not have to tell them either.
Your Honor, the slippery slope you describe of the potential preponderance of requests is something that has always been a potential negative in the public record and public access to governmental business areas, but that presumption of access and disclosure has been held as one of our most important legal principles. And so those potential, right now someone could make daily document requests of every public body in the state, and it could be very burdensome, but it's an obligation that the law requires custodians to undertake.
Mr. Burns, let me ask you whether or not the school district here has any written policy in regard to use of the government email facilities by teachers. Is there anything in the district that has a written policy concerning whether or not teachers can use the email system available for personal use?
Your Honor, the district does have a policy with regard to computer usage and technology within the district, and the district does acknowledge that it permits limited and reasonable personal use of the system.
Do you think that enters into how we should look at this case, where there is a policy from the district saying it's okay to use the email equipment for personal use?
It enters in, Your Honor, but it also is tempered by the fact that that same policy makes clear that there should be no expectation of privacy in those communications, and that it is on a district system that is subject to access by the custodians at any time.
It doesn't say it isn't. It doesn't say it is subject. It doesn't say it's not. It just is a portion. Isn't that the phraseology?
That would be an accurate description, Your Honor, yes.
Counselor, the amici raised the issue of competence, and we talked a little bit about that with opposing counsel. Should we address it? You didn't raise it. And if we should address it, what's your position on that argument, that there was no competency in the circuit court in the first instance to even review the district's decision?
Your Honor, with respect to the competency issue, it's the district's position that the amici take far too a restrictive reading of Section 19.356. While that statute creates an obligation to provide advance notice in certain instances and provide provides and a corresponding entitlement to judicial review. We don't believe that it guts out the spirit of the common law developed in Wozniacki with respect to the procedure for a custodian to invite review in order to avoid what could be potentially irreparable harm if the disclosure is made prior to that. So we believe that pre-release review in circumstances outside 19.356 is not precluded by the language. 356 creates certain obligations for custodians when faced with the particular types of records identified in 19.356, but does not abrogate the ability, similar to how the first Wozniacki case ever arose, where a district attorney made the decision that I should offer the record subjects an opportunity to join this before I release the records. Here the district should, other records custodians, and we believe it would be a disservice to record custodians to put them in a position where they would be unable to offer that sort of, invite that sort of pre-release judicial review because of the potential consequences if the release is made and then there is our privacy claims or constitutional issues raised after that.
So essentially you agree with Attorney Jonas in this regard, but your breadth of review is quite a bit different than the legislative history specifically stated on what they were doing when they made these revisions in regard to our Wozniacki opinion.
I would agree with most of opposing counsel's response in as to this issue. The one point I would take issue with is that I don't believe the statute contemplates that a requester can undertake an investigation, as that term is used in the statute. And in this instance, the district was not conducting an investigation into the email usage of these teachers. And so we would prefer to take the position that 19.356 creates obligations but does not initiate the option that a custodian would have to allow a pre-release review.
Well, when I read these arguments, I had a little different take on the result, and let me ask you about it. It appeared to me that when a record subject wants to say what you're giving out is not a record, there is no other place to have the statute interpreted but in court. Even though the custodian does make an initial interpretation, that's not considered a legally binding interpretation as it would be when a court makes it. So, you know, if that's your claim, I'm not sure how globally you get it reviewed if you don't have an opportunity to have the court say, we interpret the statute as including it or excluding it as the case may be.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree that 19.356, in a sense, begs the question that we're dealing with here today, in that it, by its terms, deals with records. It uses the term records. And so this case and others like it in the future involve a dispute over whether or not the items requested actually fit that definition of record, as we were discussing earlier with regard to personal use and notes and drafts and so forth. So,
to me, that seems like statutory interpretation. It doesn't feel like competence, which is generally a restriction on the subject matter jurisdiction of the court.
We believe that the custodians must retain discretion to be able to raise that threshold question of whether or not the item requested in the first instance is or isn't a record. And 19.356 doesn't help us with that piece of the analysis.
Well, can the record subject raise it? I mean, what if you tend to agree with Ms. Jonas that this needed to be looked at by a court, which is fine, but you don't always have that circumstance. So if we're looking at the statute, does the record subject have the ability to make that request, even though the person providing the record does not share in that view?
Yeah, I believe the record subject, if the problem, of course, if the record custodian does not offer the record subjects the opportunity to be aware that the request is
right,
made.
Right, because there's no notice. Yeah, I see that. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Counsel, what deference should we give to the memorandum of the Attorney General, which is in the WEAC brief, at page 176, where the Attorney General interprets the definition of record as excluding materials which are purely the personal property of the custodian and have no relation to his or her office, and then goes on to discuss that.
Chief Justice, I believe the problem with reliance on that reference by the Attorney General, with all due respect to the Attorney General, is that it focuses on that provision of the statute that pertains to the custodian. And again, here we're not dealing with personal property of the custodian. We're dealing with items that were originated by employees.
It says purely personal emails of public employees are not public records according to state statute. That's the heading that I was reading from in bold. And it then says these emails as to personal emails not created in connection with the official purpose of the school district. It's the content, not the medium or format, that should be the issue. Just because the district's email server was used doesn't make the emails public records. These emails are not public records because they are not created or kept in connection with the official purpose or function of the agency, according to the AG opinion, and are exempted because they are, quote, purely personal property with no relation to the office, pursuant to 19.32.2, which we were discussing. And the statutes provide that the Attorney General should give instructions and give opinions and put out materials to help us all. And so I think in our prior cases, as a result of the statute that imposes this responsibility on the Attorney General, we've examined Attorney General's materials very carefully.
And the importance of those is respected, Your Honor, but I believe, in again, with all due respect, that those opinions, given some of the very excerpts that you read, blur the line between the personal property exclusion for a custodian and the personal use provision as to the originators. And again, on the heels of Zellner and the court's pronouncements in that case, a record custodian looking at what the definitional provisions precisely refer to, and again with the strong presumption once arriving at the balancing test, concluded that an argument could not be, or conclusion could not be reached, that these were clearly not records.
Did the district make a balancing test here?
The district did make a balancing test by concluding that, first, the exclusions under the definition did not apply, and then, secondly, that there was not a public interest as opposed to the interest of personal individuals in potential personal embarrassment or personal privacy arguments that had been made, that outweighed the public interest and the strong presumption in favor of access. And similarly, the circuit court judge made the same analysis.
What about the trial court? Did it make that balance?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you have to know the contents of these emails in order to make a balance?
In this instance, the essentially was stipulated that the emails at issue contained the content of which did not deal with teaching matters or district business.
I know, but do I have to know the content in order to make the balance of the public interest in privacy versus the public interest in disclosure?
The custodian would presumably want to take that into account, Your Honor.
So if we were going to make the balance, we shouldn't. Is that it? We should send it back?
Well, I believe the court has held that the balancing test is a matter of law that's reviewed de novo.
I know, but How can we do that if we don't have the records?
That would complicate the court's ability to make that balancing test without the records themselves.
I didn't know how complicated things were.
If I might follow up on the Chief Judge's, Justice's question, you referred to Zellner earlier. Zellner, of course, was a case that involved pornographic material, and that touches on the content issue here, too. Is there any allegation that the emails involved here were pornographic in nature?
No, Your Honor, not at all. There's no allegation of any inappropriate material within the emails that would lead to disciplinary actions or policy violations with regard to the content. But the reference to Zellner was with respect to the overriding presumption that when doing the balancing test, the policy interest of full disclosure, full access to the records is one of the critical policy pieces in Wisconsin law.
Well, and certainly I don't disagree with that, but don't we have to look at those statements in Zellner in context?
The statements in context in Zellner, Your Honor, I think the other point made in Zellner is that the quantity and quality of the usage of the personal system is a legitimate public interest, and that would be part of the balancing test as well. Irregardless of the content of the emails, that the quality and quantity of the usage of the district's computer system, which is one of the arguments that the requester has made, was the purpose behind the request, although at the time a request is made, the motive is not something that the custodian is permitted to inquire into, but Zellner also stands for that proposition as well.
Counselor, I hear your arguments, and in many respects, your opponent's argument, and to somewhat the opinion of the Attorney General, characterize the issue as to whether or not the emails are for personal use or not. And so I went back to figure out when did the term records come into our statute and when did the exception come in. And when I looked at the legislative history for that, it came in Wisconsin statutes, first appeared 81 to 82. And there is no disconnect in that. In other words, not just anything that is for personal use is an exception to the public records. It is only an exception when it is both for personal use and is a draft, a note, a preliminary computation, or a like matter prepared for personal use. So I'm a little concerned about the disconnect, and I'm wondering if you think you can properly disconnect them, and anything that's done for personal use then is an exception, or do you have to meet both tests, a particular kind of item, and that particular kind of item then was prepared for the originator's personal use?
Your Honor, from the custodian's perspective in responding to the request, I think the custodian would take the position that, assuming for the sake of the analysis that it fits into the note or similar material, is it for the originator's personal use, and that's where the definition fit, the exclusion. Keeping in mind this is an exclusion that otherwise it is a record, the exclusion doesn't fit because of that. That personal use, even if you were to assume for sake of argument that an email fits within notes or like materials.
Let's not make that assumption since it is part of the exclusion. Do you think it fits with any of the stated categories or is like material?
It does not cleanly fit into any of those stated categories, Your Honor. It would take a fairly broad interpretation of either like materials or perhaps notes for it to fit within that. But custodian, I think if the personal use piece doesn't fit, that analysis isn't necessary in terms of the type of document at that point.
So if this document is not either a note, a draft, preliminary computation, or like material, then you don't need to look at whether it's for personal use because it never comes within the exception, correct?
That would also be correct, Your Honor.
Okay, because I was surprised that everybody seemed to disconnect it. And to me, for personal use was a modifier of the listed exceptions, and it seems a two-part test. So what do you think other material means? It doesn't say other. Similar material means. Give me an example.
Similar material would probably refer, Your Honor, to the to drafts, to
that's
schedules.
It's already stated. It has to be similar. So it's not a draft. It's not a note.
I think similar material would also include material that isn't transmitted to a third party. That
goes to your personal use. You define personal use as like this. Once it's out, even if it's a note, if a note were emailed or if a note was sent, if I passed a note to Justice Bradley, it's no longer under that, not a record definition, according to you, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what does similar material mean? I need an example.
Similar materials might be materials, again, it's like materials prepared for the originator's personal use. So it would be something akin.
I do emails and then don't send them. I save them, thinking then I might send them tomorrow if I don't think better of it.
Well,
so that's, would that be a record?
Well, an email that would be prepared but not sent might more appropriately fit under the draft heading.
It might, and it's still for my personal use.
Yes.
And as soon as I send it, it's no longer a draft. Is that it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's not for my personal use. Okay, so what about the similar materials? That's my problem. I can't think of one. How about sketches, designs? That's covered. Is that it? No.
Like materials is the term which is referring to drafts, notes, preliminary computations, and like materials. So items advanced beyond the originator's personal use would not be included, but like materials might be sketches, drawings.
Cartoons. As long as I don't send it. That's your position.
Yes, Your Honor.
So everything that's not sent is not a record. I mean, everything that's not sent is okay because it's personal use. So you're really not focusing on the list or similar materials. You're really focusing on whether it's sent or not, because as soon as it's sent, it is a record in your opinion.
Under the facts of this case, Your Honor, the emails, because they were prepared and sent, are no longer for the personal use. There could be other items that are drafts, notes, and so forth that...
As soon as I send the draft to somebody else, though...
It's no longer a draft.
It's no longer a draft. So the real kicker for you is once it's sent, it doesn't fall under that exception.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do teachers ever communicate with the parents of their students by email?
Presumably, yes, Your Honor.
Do. Would those be personal emails or would those be public communications?
The email correspondence between, and my time is up, I'm assuming I'm permitted
yes,
to answer
you
the question.
Should.
Those would be business-related. Those would be district business that would not fit under the discussion we've been having here, Your Honor. But more importantly, there would be student confidentiality provisions that would permit the district to redact that student information. And in fact, the district's original response, as well as the trial court's order, required redaction of any confidential student information related or conveyed in those emails.
But that wouldn't be in the statute itself, would it? That would be overriding federal law?
There would be both federal and state law pertaining to confidentiality of student information. And so the district would be in a position to redact any of that information on that basis alone.
The district did redact information here, social security numbers, medical records, home address.
Student identifications, yes, Your Honor.
What's left after you redacted all of that?
As noted in the record, Your Honor, the emails have communications that are unrelated to those items you just identified.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Jones, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to focus on the use test that the custodian was discussing. Nothing in the law contemplates that just because material is shared with another person, that doesn't mean it's for personal use. The custodian is basing that interpretation on the Fox versus Bott case. But in Fox, the county shared a memo with the sheriff's department, and the sheriff's department took official action based on that memo. And there the court held that the memo was not a draft because it was shared to the sheriff's department. But in Fox, the sheriff's department made changes based on the memo. So it was no longer a draft. It became an official document. Here, the teachers or the district didn't take any official action based on these emails. The emails have no connection to government business. And the custodian made the wrong test based on Zellner, because as Justice Kirk recognized, Zellner was a misconduct case. And here, there's no allegation of misconduct. While there is a presumption of access, 1931 clearly states that the presumption of access is consistent with the conduct of government business. Here, there is no government business contained in these emails.
Well, in Zellner, there was no government business, right? There was no government business in terms of pornography.
That's correct, but the district there took official action based on that content when it terminated Mr. Zellner. And here, the district has not taken any action based on the content of the email. So that goes back to the use test. And here, the teachers prepare the emails for their personal use.
Counselor, I think that my questions to opposing counsel show that I think it's a two-part test. If you're going to get out of this being a record, you have to show that it fits in within one of the phrases that are there, and that it was prepared for personal use. And I understand your argument about personal use. I'd like you to give me your best argument on why this is like material.
I have two responses to that. First, that like material must encompass something more than drafts or notes, or the legislature wouldn't have drafted the statute that way. So in determining what the legislature meant, you look at the context of the statute as a whole, and you also can look at the legislative history, which Your Honor did. And I'd like to direct attention to Appendix 199, in Plaintiff Appellant's appendix, where I attached the legislative history to the public records law in 1981, where the legislature drafted a definition of the record. And when the Legislative Reference Bureau analyzed the public records law, the Bureau stated that a custodian must withhold records containing information regarding the private life of an individual which would be of no legitimate public concern. So looking at that legislative history and the purpose behind the public records law, that when the legislature meant like materials, it was intending to encompass all materials that were created for personal use.
Well, you're just hooking it back to the second part of the statute, in my view. I think you have to have a document that falls within the first part of the test. It has to either be a draft, a note, a preliminary computation, or like material before you get to whether it's for was not for personal use that could be for official business.
You could, and that's what happened in the Fox case.
Right, exactly. I agree with you.
But here, in terms of what are like materials, the legislature wasn't going to craft a definition to encompass everything, but holding that like materials have to be a draft or a note is too restrictive. They put the language in there to encompass other materials. And you also have to interpret statutes to avoid absurd results. And under just holding that it's only drafts or notes would mean that anything that an employee keeps in a government office is a record. So if you have a personal photograph on your desk of your family, or you have personal letters that you keep in your desk, or cards maybe from students or parents thanking you for your service, that those would all then be records that would be subject to release. And the teachers submit that that was not the legislative intent when drafting the definition of a record. Their intent was to open government to the public and show the public how government functions. And here, personal emails show nothing about how the government is functioning. So even,
let's say I, outside of the context of a disciplinary action, am doing eBay business on my computer at work, and I'm sending notes. I'm saying, congratulations, you are the winner. Please ship, I will ship within 10 days. Is that a record under the public records law?
It would depend. If that then led to disciplinary action, because the
and outside of the disciplinary action, is that a record?
No, if you would look at the personal use and the content. So if the use was not anything to do with government business, mm-hmm. and the content had no information regarding the affairs of business, then no, that would not be a record.
And so if a newspaper wanted to get my email business records that I conducted while I was at work, they would not be able to. Is that correct?
Correct. If the use or the content, just like as Justice Prosser's question indicates, they wouldn't be entitled to receive voicemail messages that were personal that the district might have recorded.
Even though I was conducting a business through eBay at work.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. I see that my time has expired. May I briefly conclude?
One sentence.
Okay.
Medium size.
In conclusion, the legislature carefully drafted the public records law to encompass material that provides insight into the working of government, not to provide access to purely personal material. I ask this court to reverse the circuit court's order and enjoin the release of the personal emails. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jonan, and thank you, Ms. Burns, for your arguments in another open record case. A different context. That concludes our hearing on 08-AP-967-AC. Karen Schill et al. Versus Wisconsin Rapids School District et al. The court will take a brief recess so that people who wish to leave the court may do so, and that others who wish to enter the court may do so. We are in recess.